Very good. All right. My name is Jenny Smith, and you're here for what you want to know about spinal cord injury. So if you're that's not what you want to know, you're probably in the wrong spot. Just to get an idea, I'd like to know who's in the room. How many of you guys serve in the U.S. full-time? Okay. Students? Yay. All right. How many people serve overseas? Very good. All right. Well, thank you for being here today. Yes, so we're going to be talking about what you want to know about spinal cord injuries. And this is an important topic because there are over 15 million people with spinal cord injuries in the world. And until the early 20th century, spinal cord injuries were actually considered a fatal injury. And a great example of this is Lord Nelson, who is a great British naval hero. We have a great example of this on the next slide. He sustained a spinal cord injury when a bullet entered his spinal cord. And this is what is said of Lord Nelson. Lord Nelson told the surgeon, "All power of motion and feeling below my chest are gone." Mr. Beatty duly examined his patient, confirmed his spinal cord injury, then said, "No doubt," with head bowed. He said, "My lord, unhappily for our country, nothing can be done for you." A spinal cord injury was a fatal injury until the advent of catheters, especially Foley catheters in the 1930s, and antibiotics. A spinal cord injury is now considered a treatable condition, and that's why I'm here 35 years after I sustained a spinal cord injury. On a hot and humid summer morning when I was 16 years old, I was outside tumbling. I was doing something that was quite easy for me, but the grass was wet that morning. And Lindsay, you can go to the next slide. But the grass was wet, and as I was tumbling, I didn't have enough height or rotation to make it all the way around. And I landed face first in the grass. I heard a pop, and I lost all movement and sensation from about my neck down. My friends ran over to me. "Jenny, are you okay?" And I don't know where I learned this, but I told them, "Don't move me. I've broken my neck." It was a good thing I told them that, because I had sustained a C6-7 spinal cord injury that left me paralyzed from the chest down and without the use of my hands. That day changed my life, but it didn't end it. In fact, it's actually taken me places I never would have dared to imagine. For 8 years, I distributed wheelchairs in developing countries, and this was after getting my master's degree in counseling psychology. But I distributed wheelchairs in countries like Mexico and Afghanistan, following this woman in the front seat, front row. For 13 years, I served in member care, supporting cross-cultural workers as they lived and worked overseas with the emotional, spiritual, and physical impacts of serving in a cross-cultural context. I write about the hardships as well as the joys of living life with a spinal cord injury. And now I'm able to support people with disabilities with the emotional and spiritual impact of disability. On hot and humid summer mornings, you won't find me tumbling anymore, but you will find me out on the Ohio River rowing with the Louisville Adaptive Rowing Program. So, we're going to jump in to some of the impacts of a spinal cord injury. We're going to talk about the physical impact. And Lindsay, you can go to the next slide. So we're going to talk about the physical impact of spinal cord injury. And so often people know that a spinal cord injury is typically the inability to walk. But there's so many more secondary conditions that exist with a spinal cord injury. So we're going to start off pretty simply with some of the terminology associated with a spinal cord injury. We've got several different levels of spinal cord injury. So we have cervical, thoracic, lumbar and sacral, thank you, and paraplegic, tetraplegic, and quadriplegic. Am I a quad, a para, or a tetra? And this might be a trick question. No one? All right. A quadriplegic or tetraplegic has a cervical level spinal cord injury. And so all four limbs are impaired. I have, because of the lack of use of my hands, as well as a cervical level injury, I'm a quadriplegic. The medical community has changed to using tetraplegic instead of quadriplegic. I think someone with a little bit of OCD decided that para and quad didn't sync because quad is Latin and Greek is, or vice versa. Quad is Latin, Greek is, para is Greek. And so now they're using tetraplegic in the medical community. So tetraplegic and paraplegic is what's being used in the medical community. You're still going to be hearing quad used quite a bit for quadriplegics. There's also incomplete injuries and complete injuries. Someone with a complete injury will not have any feeling or function below their level of injury. Someone with an incomplete injury will have some feeling or function below their level of injury. But it's so much more complicated than that. So in 1992, there is a new classification scale called the ASIA scale. Next slide. And this defines spinal cord injuries quite a bit more than just saying complete or incomplete. And an ASIA A injury, it goes from A to E. An ASIA A injury has no sensory or motor function below their level of injury, whereas an ASIA E has no sign of motor or sensory dysfunction. And then in between, ASIA B is considered an incomplete injury. However, it's going to look very much like an ASIA A injury. The one difference is going to be that someone with an ASIA B injury is going to have voluntary anal contraction or sensation. And it really means that there is some innervation in the sacral area. And the way to determine an ASIA B injury, I am sorry for those of you who have to do this, is to insert a gloved and lubricated finger into the rectum and see if there is any either sensation or voluntary contraction of the anal sphincter. ASIA C and D have some motor and sensory function. So that's the ASIA system as simply as you're going to get it from me. To me, it's very complicated. But all of this to say that no two spinal cord injuries are alike. And let's go to the next slide. Here's an example how two spinal cord injuries can look so very different. Tom and I both have C6-7 spinal cord injuries. You can see me in all of my atrophied glory. No hand function, a lot of atrophy in my arms and wrists. Tom is also a C6-7 injury. But he's an ASIA A, or he's an ASIA C. And so you can see the difference, how he recovered almost full function in his hands, thumbs, fingers, as well as his trunk. And that's the difference between an ASIA A and an ASIA C. The important reason to remember this is because you cannot compare spinal cord injuries. And if you're a physical therapist or an occupational therapist or a doctor, well, this person is a C6 injury, so they can do this, so therefore you should be able to. It doesn't work that way. And I'm going to point out something that should also be apparent, but isn't always. Tom did not work harder or want that more than me. So please remember that. All right. Now we're going to get into the fun stuff. Next slide. Bladder and bowel. If you give people with a spinal cord injury the option between walking or having bladder and bowel function, research shows that people will choose bladder and bowel function 9 out of 10 times. That is how much bladder and bowel function is important. And so let's talk a little bit about some of the options for bladder management. Next slide. We have intermittent catheterization. This is probably the go-to for most doctors, let me put it that way. There's less risk of infection. But it can be very difficult for females as well, especially female quads. We have a Foley catheter. There's an increased risk of UTIs as well as bladder cancer with the use of Foleys. So doctors will often prefer intermittent catheterization for that purpose. But I can tell you from personal experience, I had a Foley for 17 years. And that gave me the freedom to be able to go back to high school and go back to college and get my graduate degree and not be tied to another person to be intermittently catheterized by someone else. There's no way I physically would have been able to do that. So just because intermittent catheterization is the best in your opinion does not mean that there's a higher quality of life for the person with intermittent catheterization. All right, suprapubic catheters are becoming more and more common from what I'm seeing. And this is very similar to a Foley. It's just surgically implanted through the abdomen into the bladder. So it's an indwelling catheter as well. It just doesn't go in through the urethra. It is changed every 4 weeks or thereabouts, just like a Foley. It can be tapped off or connected to a bag. So there's a little bit of freedom in how that's used as well. A urostomy is not very common with spinal cord injuries. You will see it maybe with the spina bifida population when there's been more kidney impairment from an early time in life. But if there has been either damage to the urethra or kidneys, there might be the need for a urostomy. A mitrofenov is another really great option, and this is what I have now. A mitrofenov uses a section of bowel tissue or the appendix and creates a stoma on the abdomen. And that stoma is typically only about the size of a pencil eraser, so it's really small. And it's very easy for female quads or anyone else to be able to intermittently catheterize through the abdomen and have really easy access to be able to do that. Yes, it is. At the same time, another procedure can be done called an augmentation, and this will increase the size of the bladder using bowel tissue. So because I had a Foley for 17 years, my bladder could only hold about 20 cc's after that long length of time. And so with the augmentation, I can easily hold 600 to 800 cc's of urine. And the problem is it's a big surgery. And so that's why if you can't avoid it, you want to, but it will also open up a lot of opportunities for people who don't have other options. Finally, for men, there is the option of a condom catheter, and that works just like you think it might. And there is an external catheter now for women, but it is not recommended for anyone with a neurogenic bladder. So for people with spinal cord injuries, not recommended. There are some complications that come along with spinal cord injuries. Next slide. Or with bladder management. And this includes bladder spasticity, and this is due to the neurogenic bladder. And some of the options for treatment of neurogenic bladder include anticholinergics, primarily oxybutynin, but the side effects from that can be pretty big. And so Mirbetrix is a drug that's being used more and more often for the treatment of bladder spasms. Botox is also being used more and more often for bladder spasticity with a lot of effectiveness. So those are some options for bladder spasticity. Urinary tract infections are probably one of the greatest complications with a spinal cord injury. And here's a few things that you need to know about treating UTIs. First of all, a urinalysis is not enough. If someone comes in saying, I think I have a UTI, we need to treat it, don't just treat it, for one thing. Do not just prescribe antibiotics, and we'll get to that in just a little bit. But a urinalysis is not enough. A culture is needed. We are creating so many resistant bacteria, we really need to be treating the specific bug that the person is struggling with. A urinalysis will always be positive because people who intermittently catheterize or have an indwelling catheter will be colonized with bacteria. So it's always going to come back positive. The only time that you really want to treat a UTI is if someone is symptomatic. And once again, this is important. There are times where you might want to treat it if it's not symptomatic, but only if someone is symptomatic will you want to treat it. And that typically is a 10-day course of antibiotics, not five. Because we're intermittently catheterizing or having the Foley, we want to kill that bug completely or it's just going to come back. Other options are methenamine or Hyprex, and that can be used. This is not an antibiotic, but the urine does need to be acidic for this to work, and so people might need to take some vitamin C in order to keep the urine acidic enough for this medication to work. Gentamicin irrigation. Gentamicin is also an antibiotic. This can be effective. I know a lot of people who do this. You just get a liquid prescription, put it into the bladder, and let it sit there until you go to the bathroom the next time. Over-the-counter options are Elura or D-mannose, and also can be very effective. Those primarily only work with E. coli infections, though, so that needs to be aware of. So this is the statistic I'd like to share with you. Next slide. About some of the resistant bacteria. In 2015, a report by the World Health Organization said that scientists found rates above 25 to 50% of resistance to antibiotics commonly used to treat UTIs. What made spinal cord injuries a treatable condition? Antibiotics. What's going to happen if antibiotics are no longer an option or available? Will no longer be an effective treatment for so many conditions that accompany a spinal cord injury. So this is why this is so important. All right, next slide. Bowel. How do quads and paras poop? It's a really crappy situation. And it truly is. The goal of the bowel program is to have the bowel only move when you want it to. And there's two different, the way that you do a bowel program is going to depend on the level of injury. Someone with a T12 injury or higher is going to have a reflex bowel. Someone with a T12 injury or lower will have a flaccid bowel. And so above T12, typically that anal sphincter is going to stay tight, and so you'll need to use a suppository or a mini enema in order to produce peristalsis. This is going to get things moving, but the anal sphincter is going to stay tight. So the next step is to do digital stimulation. And yes, it is as miserable as it sounds. So with a gloved, lubricated finger, you'll insert that into the rectum, make a circular motion until that anal sphincter relaxes. So that is how people with higher level injuries will do their bowel program. Lower level injuries will do manual evacuation. So that's the flaccid bowel. That anal sphincter is not going to stay tight. Where with the bowel program, you can do that maybe 3-4 times a week. Some people do it daily, but with manual evacuation, you probably need to do that more frequently, once to twice a day, simply because there's higher risk of having accidents. So there are some other options, and this includes Peristeen, which is a transanal irrigation option. Colostomy is another option. I put a QR code up there I wrote this article for New Mobility, and so more and more people are switching to the option of a colostomy. A bowel program can take 2 hours. And so just for time management, as well as making things easier to deal with, a colostomy can be an option if things are not working properly. A MACE procedure is that the image up there. It is a surgical procedure where you create a stoma, and that it's basically an enema that goes directly into the bowel from the top of the bowel that will flush the bowel out. So those are some options with the bowel program. Any questions? Yeah.
What are the potential side effects or consequences of having colonoscopies?
Colonoscopies? Oh, man. Or a colostomy.
Yeah.
There's fewer risks with a colostomy than doing the bowel program. So with the bowel program, hemorrhoids are a big complication just due to the digital stimulation. So bleeding, anemia, that can be, and that's why some people go to the colostomy. With the colostomy, I am not as familiar with some of the complications. I know that there can be problems with just backing up and things not moving well. But that's also true of the bowel program. Other option complications. I know when the wall of the abdomen. Hernia. Thank you. Yeah. Abdominal hernias around that stoma can be a complication. Yeah. Thank you. Yes. Yeah. So she's saying a couple of the other complications are just finding the right appliances that work for you. And from what I'm learning, there are more and more options every day. So people can really find the type of bag, whether it's a one-time use or multiple-use bag. And that's where wound care and ostomy nurses are really, really helpful. Do I see a wound care and ostomy nurse back there? Or I just saw some nodding. So, yes, and then the gas. So the gas can be heard sometimes. And so that can be a problem. All right, skin integrity and pressure sores. So next slide. We've been sitting here long enough where some of you guys are wiggling around a little bit, and your butt's going numb, and your brain is telling you that, you need to scoot around a little bit. Someone with a spinal cord injury does not have that feedback to tell them, oh, it's time to move. My butt's getting tingly. I'm losing sensation. And so when that happens, the circulation for the blood is cut off. Oxygen is not getting to the tissue, and that can cause skin breakdown. And that is how a wound develops. When I mentor new spinal cord injuries, I put the fear of God in them about skin care. And each night when I get home, get into bed, take my clothes off, I grab a mirror and I look at my butt every single night. And it's always with fear and trembling, to be honest. I've had a history of skin flaps, and I never want to do that again. So I'm hyper-vigilant about skin care. And that's something to, when you're in the midst of rehab and being taught all this stuff, it's like a fire hose. You know it, you've heard it, but you don't get it until it actually happens, unfortunately. And so what we primarily want to do is prevent wounds. So how can we prevent pressure sores? First and foremost is just pressure relief. And so it's recommended about every 20 to 30 minutes someone do a pressure relief. That can be done just by lifting up, leaning side to side, tilting in a power chair if someone has a power chair, or reclining. Or actually, if someone is in a manual chair, just to manually tilt them back to get that pressure off of their bottom. I'll go ahead and mention this. We'll see how we're doing with time. You guys have probably heard that in a hospital setting and even at home, someone should be turned every 2 hours. Have you heard that? Does anyone know where that came from? After World War II at Stoke Mandeville Hospital in England, The doctor there, I can't remember his name right offhand, found that those patients who were turned more often had fewer complications and fewer skin breakdown. So he decided, you know what? Everyone on the ward needs to be turned. So the nurses would start with the first person, make their way around, and by the time they got back to the first person, it had been 2 hours. I don't believe there's any clinical research for every 2 hours. But that's kind of what is taught. Once someone transfers home from rehab, that is exhausting. So if forever, whoever is the caregiver, if someone is not able to turn themselves, it's just exhausting. So everyone is going to be different. Once again, we're going to go back. No two spinal cord injuries are the same. No two butts are the same. So there are some people I know who can stay in the same spot the entire night without any problems. Other people do have to have an alternating mattress or other options or be moved to prevent skin breakdown throughout the night. So cushions, let's go to the next slide. This is another way of preventing skin breakdown if you have access to some good cushions. I often hear people ask, what is the best cushion? That is not the question people need to be asking. The question is, what is the best cushion for me? Once again, no two people are the same. And there's a variety of cushions that are made and that are available here in Western countries. But the best way to determine which cushion is best is on the top right of the slide. You'll see a pressure mapping system. And this is a thin mat that goes in between the patient and the cushion. And it'll give you a visual representation of how much pressure is on that cushion. It's a really great way, when you have no sensation, to know what cushion is going to be best. I know you can try a variety of cushions, and one can feel really great. I know about 2 years ago, I was looking for a new cushion, and it just felt incredible. And then we mapped it, and it just lit up. It was red, just like, I don't have, mine are a lot bonier than that. But it was quite red. And so we just knew that wasn't going to be an option, even though it was more comfortable. And so having that visual feedback of pressure mapping is really, really great. But what if you don't have access to cushions, like we do here in the U.S. or in some Western countries? The QR code up on the screen is a great resource. It's written by David Werner. And he's who wrote Where There Is No Doctor. And these are all resources of how to do stuff when you don't have access to the high-tech things that we have here in the U.S. And in one of the pictures up on the screen, you'll see a custom-made cushion made out of cardboard. And so there are ways for cushions to be made, created, figured out. Foam, cutting out foam to customize it are some options. But what happens when there is a wound and we need to heal it? Well, first of all, catch it early and get off of it. And I'm not saying at stage 3 or stage 4, get off of it. Stage 1, get off of it. I try to tell myself when I'm having to make that difficult decision of not being able to do something and having to stay in bed, something that has developed while sitting up is not going to heal while I'm sitting up. And so even if it's a stage 1, I'll get into bed maybe 2 hours up, 2 hours down for a couple days until that spot is gone. Not everyone does that. I've learned my lesson, and I'm just going to be hypervigilant. But catching it early is what you need to do. If you don't, a wound care doctor is so valuable. They'll know the resources that are out there, different ways to manage wound care. And if that is not available, and there is an open wound that needs to be treated, a really great solution is honey mixed with sugar. And this is antimicrobial and antibacterial, and so you want to clean the wound out with saline solution or boiled water. Rinse that wound out really well, pack it with the paste, cover it with a bandage, and depending on how much that wound is weeping throughout the day, you might need to change it 2 to 3 times a day. Sometimes it will only need to be once a day. But if you don't have any other resources, that is one way to treat wounds effectively. There's some great research articles on this as well. All right, next slide. We're going to talk about autonomic dysfunction, and this is really important to talk about. For people with a T6 injury or higher, the autonomic nervous system is impaired. So the autonomic nervous system helps regulate blood pressure and heart rate, temperature regulation, as well as digestion. So it does a lot. The blood pressure will typically run low for someone with a T6 injury or higher, and it's typically 15 to 20 points below normal. So those of you who are nurses, do not freak out when you see an 80 over 60 for me. That's normal. But it's just good for people to know what their baseline blood pressure is. It's really, really important, and we'll talk about why that's important in a little bit. Ways to manage a low blood pressure, this can really impact people's quality of life. And so being able to manage that blood pressure is really important. And staying hydrated is one simple way. Midodrine is a medication that can be used. Some people don't like the side effects of that, and they'll choose Sudafed instead. An abdominal binder can be used. I don't know if earlier you saw me doing this for a little bit. I'm creating an abdominal binder when my blood pressure was going low, and it's very, very helpful, and I find myself doing that quite a bit. Compression stockings and sodium. What you'll probably want to do for someone who's trying to stay hydrated and probably trying to drink a lot to prevent urinary tract infections, they might be flushing out all of the electrolytes. So do a BNP, get a baseline sodium level to see if adding in sodium might help with the blood pressure. I've started taking 1 gram of sodium a day, and it's changed things for the better quite a bit. Another thing to be aware of is temperature regulation. You can see me with my scarf on. You will rarely find me without a scarf, and that's because I run cold. So body temperature will typically be 1 degree below normal for people with a higher level injury. But overheating can be a really big issue as well. Because we don't sweat, there's no way for the body to cool down. And overheating is just so easy to happen. And it can happen. I was rowing a couple weeks ago. It was beautiful outside, 80 degrees, sunny, and rowed 4 miles. And I'm like, oh, man, here we go. I probably should have stopped earlier, but I didn't. But got off the river, and my temperature was 102. And so it happens very easily. I always keep a thermometer on me so I can kind of gauge that. And that's something that you can learn over time. One thing you're going to learn about people with spinal cord injuries is that they're pretty good at reading their bodies. I still like to have the thermometer with me just so I can really know I'm not crazy, my temperature is that high. Okay, another thing about autonomic dysfunction that we need to discuss is autonomic dysreflexia. And this is when the sympathetic nerves get stimulated and it sends signals to constrict the blood vessels. In someone without a spinal cord injury, the brain would typically slow the heart rate and dilate the blood vessels. Those messages can't get sent with a T6 injury or higher. And so instead, the blood pressure will increase. And I like to call this will happen when there is a stimulus below the level of injury. It can be bladder, bowel, it can be a number of things. But I call it God's emergency backup system. Because my body is telling me that something is wrong below my level of injury. It doesn't tell me what is wrong, but it tells me that something is wrong. So what are some of the symptoms of autonomic dysreflexia? Next slide. Increased blood pressure, a pounding headache, sweating, goosebumps, blurred vision, or a stuffy and runny nose. And the blood pressure can sometimes be dangerously high. And if autonomic dysreflexia is left untreated, stroke, heart attack, and death can be a cause, can be caused. And so it's very important if you have a patient with a higher level spinal cord injury and they're saying, man, my head's really hurting, my heart's pounding, I'm sweating and I don't normally sweat. What's that going to cue you to think? AD. And so what do we do if we know that we're experiencing autonomic dysreflexia? First thing to do if you're not already in a seated position is to sit up, because that will hopefully lower the blood pressure. But then we need to find the cause. And the most common causes are bladder, bowel, and skin. And this can be just emptying the bladder, making sure that the bladder isn't full, making sure that there's not impaction or other stuff going on with the bowel. Actually, even wrinkles in clothing can cause autonomic dysreflexia, so it's important to check all of those. If you still can't find the cause and blood pressure is continuing to be very high, then it might be time to get out nitro paste, which is a vasodilator, and that will just be putting a little bit of paste above the level of injury, waiting until the blood pressure goes down, and then wiping it off. I have never had to use nitro paste, and I'm a little scared of it, to be honest, because your blood pressure can bottom out if you leave it on too long. And so I have it. I actually keep it with me, but I've never had to use it. On the next page, on the next slide, there we go. This is an informational card that's really, really helpful. You can get this from the Christopher and Dana Reeve Foundation. And you can ask for physical copies or digital copies, PDF versions. But these are available in over 30 languages. So if you know someone with a spinal cord injury, or if you're in a healthcare setting where you're trying to either educate other healthcare practitioners or people with spinal cord injuries, this is a really great resource to know about. One thing I also want to mention is that we need to go back to what is the baseline blood pressure for someone with a T6 injury or higher. Autonomic dysreflexia is defined I think it's about 15 to 20 points above normal, the average blood pressure of someone. So if I know that my average blood pressure is 80 over 60, and I tell you something's wrong, something's really wrong, my blood pressure is really high, and you take my blood pressure, and it's 130, 120 over 80, what are you going to say? Nothing's wrong. Something is wrong. That is considered autonomic dysreflexia for someone if that is 15 to 20 points above their resting blood pressure. So please listen to your patients. I have been in settings where I've experienced autonomic dysreflexia and been brushed off. And it's a really scary thing when you know things can go so terribly wrong if it's not treated. All right, we're going to rush through some other secondary issues on the next slide. The first one is spasticity. This is involuntary tightening of a muscle or muscle groups of muscles. And this can really hamper independence. Muscle spasms can be just not very strong at all. People can actually use their spasticity to increase their independence. Other people will be really hampered by their spasticity. And management, range of motion, first and foremost, just kind of start with the basics. Oral medications, baclofen, Neurontin, Dantrium, Valium are some of the go-tos that typically can work or might work. In my case, I was on all four, and I was still kicking my shoes off. That's how strong my spasticity was. And at that time, I went to my doctor, and I'm like, can you cut my spinal cord? Can you do an alcohol wash? What other options are there? I was 3 years into my injury, and I was at the point where, okay, I know this injury is permanent. I was at that mindset knowing that things weren't going to change, but I wanted to be more independent, and with that spasticity, I couldn't be. And thankfully, Medtronic was starting their research into the implantable pumps. So the intrathecal pump gets implanted into the abdomen. There's a catheter that runs from the pump into the spinal fluid and delivers baclofen. directly into the spinal fluid. I am on no oral medications now. My legs are flaccid. That's how I choose to have them be. But it's a really, really, really great option when nothing else is working. All right. Bone density and osteoporosis is a very big, it's not even a risk. It will happen. In fact, it begins within the first 2 weeks after a spinal cord injury. And over 80% of people with chronic spinal cord injuries will develop osteoporosis. So fractures can happen very easily. So that's something to be aware of. Neuropathic pain. I think this is one of the cruelest parts of a spinal cord injury, is to have no feeling and yet to experience severe debilitating pain. And it varies from person to person, just like everyone else, but it can be distracting as well as debilitating. Medication is an option, a pain pump, a spinal stimulator can also be an option. For myself, mine is not that bad. I find that endorphins are a glorious thing, and exercise is my go-to option. It's just, first of all, it just gets your mind off of the pain. I think dwelling on the pain can actually increase it, and so exercise just gets those endorphins flowing, and it's God's little great medicine that he's given us. All right, obesity, increased risk of diabetes, and cardiovascular disease. Let's talk first about weight. First of all, for those of you who practice in the States, in your offices, how many of you have a wheelchair-accessible scale? Okay. So when you ask me how much I weigh, how am I supposed to answer you? Without being a smart aleck, which I've been known to do. Where is your accessible scale that you're required to have under the ADA? This is important. Paraplegics should weigh 5 to 10% less than before their injury, not just before, but a healthy weight before their injury. Quadriplegics should weigh 10 to 15% less, and this is because of the muscle atrophy. But this also means that people need to be taking in about 35% fewer calories than they were before their injury. And we don't talk about this. And so this is why the risk of obesity is so high. So we don't have much time to talk about this, but the QR code up here. The first one is an article that I wrote about maintaining your health after a spinal cord injury, and it talks some about the exercise and calories and weight issues. And then the bottom one is a workshop by Christopher West, and he's a leading researcher on cardiometabolic changes after a spinal cord injury. This workshop is a little depressing to watch if you have a spinal cord injury, to see all the cardiometabolic changes after a spinal cord injury. But the good news is that with 20 minutes of cardio exercise 4 times a week, those changes can be reversed. And so that's so one reason why it's so important to get people moving after a spinal cord injury. So those of you who are rec therapists, OTs, PTs, who get people into sports, keep it up. One more thing I'm going to mention about weight, why weight, it's important to know someone's weight. Last year, I had just flown back from Italy, had some skin breakdown. Stayed off my butt, got into bed, got back up, skin breakdown again. Got back into bed, got up, skin breakdown again. Got back into bed, finally made it back to the gym, and I weighed myself where I could weigh myself. Guess what? We were not treating the right thing. I was 4 pounds underweight. This is why scales and weight is important. That much can determine. I've not had a problem since. And so I had to gain some weight. I had to be intentional about that. But that's why weight is important. All right, let's go on to the next slide, which is the emotional impact of a spinal cord injury. A spinal cord injury is so much more than the loss of function. It's a loss of independence. It's a loss of control of one's life. It's the financial burdens and strains that accompany disability. And we have the medical community that focuses on our physical well-being. But who is focusing on the emotional impact of a spinal cord injury? Rates of depression and anxiety among people with disabilities is about 4 times higher than the able-bodied population. And this is not due to the disability or the injury itself. This is due to the lack of social interaction that often accompanies a disability. And so what options are there? Well, here in the U.S., we typically have a rehab psychologist in a rehab setting. But rehab stays are so short now, maybe 4 weeks if you're lucky, 4, maybe a little bit more if you're a quad. And during those first four weeks, you're in the midst of chaos. You are not ready to talk to a psychologist. We have peer mentors, which are one of my favorite options, because it's someone who has experienced a spinal cord injury. And they will be able to tell people, to tell their story, what their experience has been, and be able to show people the ropes. I'm often asked to come in to the rehab hospital here in town. And if I know it's a woman, anywhere between 16 and whatever, you know what I bring? I bring my makeup. The person who came to visit me showed me how to put mascara on. That is not life-changing, but it was for a 16-year-old girl who wanted to look pretty. And so peer mentors are just a beautiful source of support. Outpatient social workers can also be a wonderful resource. There's just not enough of them. There's not enough support in general. Several years ago, I was doing a training for member care. I was learning about third culture kids and some of the things that they go through. So third culture kids are people who, kids who are growing up on the field in a cross-cultural setting. And one of the things I suddenly realized were the parallels between transitioning to life overseas and transitioning to life with a disability. I'm not sure why I had never seen the parallels before. I'd been working in this field for 10 years at that point. But the parallels, we both have to learn a new language. One is just medical terminology. We both lose friends, maybe family members, in the midst of all of the transition. There's so many parallels. And so what I ended up doing, the idea that God gave me, was to adapt the models of cross-cultural transition and debriefing to the world of disability. And so what happened, I can almost say that it just kind of happened, is the journey and what I'm getting to do now. And this is an educational support group to help people cope with the emotional and spiritual impact of disability. And for the past 2 years, I've been able to facilitate 6 online support groups. And it's online intentionally because so many people don't have access to transportation. But it's also opened it up for people from all over the U.S. as well as overseas to be part of these groups. In March, or I guess in early February, I was in Honduras, and we were able to do a 3-day conference of the journey of the material to really be able to support people with the emotional and spiritual impact of disability. And then in March, next slide, I published the workbook so that it could be replicated. I don't want to keep this to myself, but it needs to be out there as a resource. And so the workbook is available in English and Spanish, and it contains group discussion questions, activities, and personal reflection questions. And so it can be used individually in a group setting, for peer support. It can be used in a variety of ways. What we do is start off with reflecting. Often the first year after a spinal cord injury is so full of therapy and doctor's appointments that people don't even have a time to process what has actually happened. And so by reflecting backwards on our story, it allows us to move forward. We name our losses. We have tangible and intangible losses. The tangible loss is the loss of independence and the loss of just simply being able to walk. But the intangible losses are on the next slide. Whoops, I guess not. There we go. Sorry. Yeah. So loss of identity, loss of income, loss of relationships, loss of confidence or self-image, loss of faith, loss of privacy and independence. How many of does someone in your life know every time you pee and poop? There's that loss of privacy is big. Loss of holiday traditions. After my injury, I could no longer get up early on Christmas morning by myself. And I remember the first time my brother set a gift on my lap, and I was trying to figure out, how am I supposed to open a wrapped present? So there's a loss of traditions. Loss of dreams for the future. And a loss of safety and security. These are some of the losses that need to be able to be expressed, but also grieved. And that's where we need to be able to see that all loss is significant and all loss can be mourned. But I don't know that we're really good at mourning, and we don't know how to do that, grieving. So on the next slide, we talk about grief. And I like to use the Trauma Healing Institute model of grief. We talk about the neighborhood of anger and denial, and the neighborhood of no hope, and the neighborhood of new beginnings. And we'll go in and out of these, and the goal is to make it to the neighborhood of new beginnings. But some of us, maybe me, didn't grow up knowing how to express emotion. Or it's just too hard. And so we take that false bridge, and we just skip all the messiness because we don't know what to do with it. But that false bridge never gets to the neighborhood of new beginnings. So we just push it down. I had mastered the art of stuffing my emotions as a gymnast. I didn't know how to work my way out of that. So it was only with peer mentors and other people where I got to be with them and see, oh, okay, this is how we do this. And so being comfortable and going in and out of the neighborhood of anger and denial and no hope. Can we do that? We may revisit the neighborhoods on multiple occasions throughout our life, but the goal is not to set up residency in any of those neighborhoods. Next slide. There's some other ways that spinal cord injury impacts us emotionally. It's just experiencing change can be difficult, but a spinal cord injury happens to us. We are not in control. So we need to learn how to transition. But we have the option. We choose how or if we transition and adapt to life with a spinal cord injury. So learning that difference between change and transition is really important. Living in paradox. Paradox is two opposite yet equally true statements. Life can be really hard, and life can be really good. But living with a spinal cord injury, we need to learn how to live in that tension of paradox, where we can know that both are true and still be able to go, okay, I can live for tomorrow. Coping with stress and trauma. There's a lot of stress with life with a spinal cord injury. I have a flyer up at the front, and it is entitled, it's a handout for a spinal cord injury survivor job description. And it's kind of a tongue-in-cheek job description for someone with a spinal cord injury. And it talks a lot about some of the stressors and stuff that you need to know and stuff that you need to do on a daily basis. So being able to cope with stress is really important. We need to be able to refill our emotional, physical, and spiritual resources. But how do we do that when we probably lost some of the ways that we would go to be able to refill that? If I needed to be refilled, I would go and play piano or maybe go and get a good workout. And both of those were stripped away from me. So I had to learn other ways to refill my emotional, physical, and spiritual resources. Once again, this is where PTs, OTs, and rec therapists are our best friends. Finding meaning and purpose in life. To thrive after a spinal cord injury, we need to find purpose and meaning in life. And this may feel impossible when everything about us has been stripped away. But I like to think about the saying, he who has a why to live can bear with almost any how. And so we talk, and people will write their purpose and meaning statement during this last session. All right. Spiritually, a spinal cord injury does impact us spiritually. Next slide. Whether we come from a faith-based background or not, when something bad happens, we all ask the question, why? And why is a spiritual question? So we also need to be able to balance faith and science. I remember when the neurosurgeon came in after my spinal fusion, and he said, there's a 1% chance of you ever walking again. Doctors would not do that today. This was 35 years ago. But I think it was the right thing to do. But I also knew that a large Christian convention was going on in town at that very time, and thousands of people were praying for me. How do you balance that? So we're going to go to the next slide, and Lindsay's going to show a short video, and I hope the audio works. We didn't test this out.
Now Jenny talks with determination about working hard to get well.
I see some good things come out of it. I know that I'm going to get better somewhat. I don't know how much better, but I guess that just depends on how much, that's one thing, how much God wants me to get better.
My faith was and is the foundation on which I live. But how do you balance God's ability to heal with a seemingly unwillingness to do so? It's a question I still wrestle with, and I think if we're honest, we probably all do. During the journey, when we talk about grief, I have people write a lament. And a lament is a statement expressing a combination of sadness and anger and helplessness, and it usually contains a request or a complaint directed at God. And I'd like to read Laura's lament to you. It's up on the screen. Next slide.
Now Jenny talks with determination about working hard to get well.
Try the arrow. Yep. All right. This is Laura's lament. Oh, dear God, maybe you have already stopped listening because you are upset with my battle of faithfulness since my accident. But in the event that you are still listening, I still question why. Why not just take me to heaven when you had the perfect chance? Why make me continue to live and figure out how to best serve the world in this way? Why put this pressure of life with me and everyone surrounding me also? Please listen and please help. You don't have to take away what has happened, but I need guidance on how to find happiness and contentment for myself and others. Maybe I deserve this for the bad things that I have done. I will admit they don't seem that bad or deserving of this. Show me you are still here and answering, and I will put my faithfulness battle to rest. Maybe even someday I will finally say thank you for saving my life. Our spiritual lives and beliefs are impacted from a spinal cord injury. I hope this workshop has covered some of the questions that you might have about spinal cord injuries, especially about the physical, emotional, and spiritual impact of a spinal cord injury. On the next screen, you'll find a few resources. And I do have two books. The one is The Journey that I mentioned earlier. The other is My Story. But the QR code, this is really important. The conference is doing evaluations through the QR codes this year. So if you can please fill out the QR code. If you fill out an evaluation, you are entered into a contest for $400 worth of goodies. So I'm told to pass that along. I am more than willing to answer any questions if you have them. So I am here and willing to answer any questions that you have. And you know what? I just realized I skipped the sex part. Sure. podcast gift that there was so much content, and they're like 45 minutes. I'm like, oh no, something has to go. So sex went out the window. Unfortunately, that happens with the medical profession as well. We don't talk about it. So the first QR code is an article I wrote about how people with disabilities are often seen as asexual. We just don't talk about sex and disability. I can tell you on one hand the number of times people have asked if I've dated someone when all my single friends are complaining about the nosy church ladies who are asking, are you dating anyone? Why is that? It's because we don't want to talk about sexuality and disability. The other two resources are, I'll just end with this, some really great resources from Craig Hospital on sexual function after disability. And this will give you everything that you need to know instead of me having to say it. All right, any questions? He's asking about depression. What do you do? I think it depends on your role. So if someone is clinically depressed, then we need to get a professional involved. That's not where a peer should step in and try to do anything. But as a peer or as a medical professional, just talk. Sometimes people just need a safe place to be able to talk and express those things that are a little bit scary, just like Laura's lament. So often we just hold that in because there's not a safe person to talk with. Our caregivers are overwhelmed, and if those are our parents, that's not safe because then we feel guilty for being ungrateful or feeling ungrateful for their care. So I think depression is just one of those things people do have to go through. Everyone's going to be different with depression. I am so grateful I never experienced depression. I also wasn't willing to go there. So there's some of that there as well. I'd like to turn to the expert here. Anything to add with that? Medication may be needed. Exactly.
First of all, thank you for sharing your experience. I work in the orthopedic surgery space.
Okay.
I'm wondering if you had any personal experience with lower extremity fracture, what that was like, being casted to get surgery.
Thankfully, no. Well, I will say not yet, because it's one of my biggest fears. So he's asking about lower extremity fractures, if I've had any experience with that. This was part of the sex talk, I guess. But I am still on birth control pills, and so that can help with bone density. And so I'm just grateful I'm not in menopause yet. I'm taking that for all it's worth, even though, you know, it comes with all the other stuff. But so prevention can be really helpful. Casting is not recommended due to pressure sores, and I think that's something that we finally learned. So more often than not, people will be put in a soft splint just to keep that leg in the correct position. As prevention, I would say getting involved with a good endocrinologist and doing any preventative for osteoporosis would be really important. That can involve medication, but sometimes it's just doing DEXAs on a regular basis just to kind of know what the risk factor is. I've not had to be treated yet with any medication, so I'm just grateful for that. I know doctors seem to vary depending on whether they want to do surgery or not. I've heard some people say, yeah, go ahead and do the surgery. That way, if I fall again, it's not going to break. don't know how valid of an argument that is, but it does seem to be a quicker recovery, actually, with surgery than without. And so I don't know if that's what you've seen or not. Yeah. I would say, like, healing it and getting it where it needs to be. Of course, surgery will cause AD. So, but just the fact that you're aware of that is two thumbs up, if I could. Two thumbs up. Yeah. He's asking about autonomic dysreflexia. Is that only T6 and higher? In theory, yes, but there are people with lower level injuries that do experience autonomic dysreflexia. So I know people with injuries as low as T10 who will experience AD. So in theory, only T6 and above. In reality, that's not always the case. That's a great question.
You mentioned a little bit about diet, like taking sodium and taking vitamin C for different reasons. I was wondering, living with spinal cord injury, do you have diet restrictions?
He was asking if I have any diet restrictions. I would say I do not. I just try to find a good, healthy middle. I also will pay attention to my body and eat when I am hungry. And eat. And, you know, a lot of times people will say, oh, you haven't eaten enough. I'm like, I've eaten enough for me. And weight is so important because for transfers, I'm having to lift my body weight. And so if I gain 20, 30, 40 pounds, that's going to make transfers a lot more difficult. It's going to make skin breakdown more possible. Also, weighing too little can cause that. So you have to be really careful. So once again, everyone's going to be different with that. But being able to read your body is really important. On one trip for when I was doing member care, I was in Prague walking around the city the whole day with some friends, with some coworkers, and I was in my manual chair, so I'd been pushing the whole day. And we go out for dinner that evening, and I ate dinner, and everyone starts giggling at the end of dinner. I'm like, what? What did I do? What do I have on me? I'm like, we have never seen you eat that much. And I'm like, oh, this is what happens when I work out. And so it's just knowing your body and being able to give it what it needs. And that's something that I don't think Americans do very well in general. So something that we need to learn.
Jenny, do you live at home or are you independent?
I live in my own condo, so I've been on my own for about 18 years. It took me a while to get there, but it was a process, and it was glorious when I finally launched out on my own. I think it was probably just as glorious for my parents. I do have some help, so I have two mornings a week. I have help for about 2 hours, maybe, just with getting in and out of the shower. Transfers in and out of the shower, bare butts don't slide. I'm not comfortable with it, so I do have help. And then just have some extra help during that time with folding the laundry, maybe some food prep. I know I can skin and cut potatoes, but that's going to take me 45 minutes, so I'd rather just let Molly do it in 5 minutes, pay her to do it. So it's finding that balance of independence and accepting help that can be really difficult. For those of you who are in PT and OT, no one ever pushed me to do something on my own. It was when I was at a tennis tournament out in Arizona, and my friend didn't come up to help me get into bed. Because at that point, I mean, I could transfer on my own, but I always had someone there just in case I fell. But she didn't come, and she didn't come. And so finally, threw my stuff into bed because I was really angry and decided I needed to transfer. So I transferred into bed, got my legs up. All right. Got to get the shoes off. So got the shoes off. Got to get the pants off. Got the pants off. Had a Foley at the time. Actually managed to switch the bag out to the night bag. And then I started bawling. Because that was the one thing I didn't think was possible. And it was at that time Bree walked through the door, and she's like, Jenny, what's wrong? I did it! And she said, Mike wouldn't let me come up. He said, you'd do it if I wasn't here to help you. But Michael also uses a wheelchair. And he knew that I needed a push. And so sometimes we need those people in our lives to give us a push in the right direction. And so if you are that person, be willing to do that. Once again, I'm going to go back to sports. Sports can be so important for gaining independence and strength and just learning from other people. That peer support is incredible. All right, well, thank you for being here today, and fill out your evaluation. I do have information cards and those little brochures up on the table, too.